And for you all that are working with us on Tools for Bible Study Week, get out your large text of Jude. And let's mark our tenses of the verbs down through verse 10. Remember, the theme in Bible marking is based on the idea that faded ink is much better than a good memory. And therefore, we need, for things that are hard to come by, to capture them and reserve them permanently. And so if you're thinking, well, how long is it going to take me to find the tense of the verbs and so forth in the New Testament? Well, you'll at least go home with Jude, all marked and ready to go as far as marking those things. And you want to mark them systematically. That's very important, systematic marking. And I saw floating around, are any of those things still floating, Jim, the tenses? Okay, maybe we'll run some. Okay. Here's what we have done so far. Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James, to those who are the called beloved. And notice beloved is marked as a perfect tense. What does that mean? It means completed action with abiding results. And the dot means completed action, and the line is the abiding result. So the idea involved in it, that you have been loved historically, you have been loved specifically. What would you say the specific point at which the love was manifested would be? The cross. So the historic part of the perfect tense, you have been loved. Think of the cross as the specific event. And you're still loved. And the love of God for you will remain permanent and continue on. So that perfect tense means completed act, permanency, and abiding results. In a specific event, you have been loved permanently with abiding results. Beloved in God the Father and kept. Once again, perfect tense. Kept, it's a historic act, and it continues on permanently and into the presence. Kept for Jesus Christ, may mercy and peace and love be multiplied. Be multiplied would be a aorist tense, means may grace and mercy and peace be specifically multiplied to you, and specifically multiplied again, and specifically multiplied again, and specifically multiplied again. The idea then would be the dot gets repeated. So it's the idea of grace and peace is multiplied, 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 Tuesday, multiplied, multiplied, Wednesday, multiplied, 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 Thursday, and on and on and on. A whole series of specific events wherein the mercy and peace and love of God be multiplied to you. Verse 3. Beloved, while I was making, and I was making, again, is a linear tense. I was making, and it was in the imperfect. So imperfect means continuous action in the past. I was in the process of making. I was in the middle of the job would be the idea. I was in the process of making every effort to write, present tense infinitive. I was in the process of writing. What that means is Jude is saying, I didn't plan to write. I wasn't going to do it tomorrow. I was in the very act of writing. So while I was making every effort and I was in the act of writing to you about our common salvation, we're told I felt the necessity. I felt aorist tense. It was a specific event. So in this process of doing the writing, something specific happened to Jude. And he was specifically came to feel, and we'll talk about that word later, I felt the necessity to write, aorist, speaking of a specific event, a specific epistle, and in that epistle I was to write appealing, present tense, appealing to you over and over again, or continually appealing, that you contend earnestly, one word, do it all the time. That you keep on contending earnestly all of the time for the faith which was once for all delivered, specific event, it's not happening. Faith delivered to the saints means the revelation wasn't ongoing. It's done. It's signed, sealed, and delivered to the saints. Verse 4. For certain persons have crept, aorist, he's thinking of a specific event, in unnoticed, those who were long beforehand marked off, marked out, perfect tense. Marked out historically with abiding results for this condemnation, ungodly persons who turn, present tense, not turn, but who are turning the grace of God into lasciviousness and deny, present tense, and are denying. So he's looking at ongoing activity. He's not saying, with the English, you could talk about ungodly persons who turn and deny. Perhaps it's something that happened in time. It's going on. They're right there, turning and denying. And where are they doing it? If you let your eye go down to verse 12. These men are, present tense, those who are hidden reefs in your love feast, when they feast, they are feasting, present tense, with you. So Jude is talking about a real, living situation that is going on at that very moment. So, to take verse 4 and paraphrase it, certain persons have crept in, specific event, unnoticed. They were long beforehand marked off, historically and with abiding results, permanent results for this condemnation, ungodly persons who turn, who are continually turning, presently turning, the grace of our God into licentiousness, and they're denying all of the time our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. And let me stop for just a moment right there. Notice by punctuation, principle of interpretation, strip out all the verses. They're not inspired. Two, strip out all the punctuation. It's not inspired. So we're going to want to focus a little bit later on Master and Lord, and we'll strip out that, and I think we should punctuate it differently. Take the comma out and put the comma there. Our only Master, God the Father, and Lord, Jesus Christ. But I haven't told you why I think that ought to be done, so don't just accept the interpretation yet. Treat every teacher with suspicion. That's very important, and I know that doesn't sound nice, but treat every teacher with suspicion. 1 John teaches us to do that. We're close enough, we can take a look back to 1 John. Chapter 4. Verse 1 says, do not believe. And the way it's constructed in Greek is stop it. Stop believing every spirit. And that means John is saying, I'm writing to gullible people. This is 1 John 4. I'm writing to gullible people. You're doing something you shouldn't do. You're believing everybody that comes along. So stop believing every spirit. But test the spirits to see whether they're gone from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. According to verse 1, what kind of chances do you have of coming under the spell of a false prophet or a false teacher? Better than 50-50. Doesn't say a few, it says many. There are a lot of them out there. So the chances of falling to a false teacher probably will. How many people in this world will fall to false teachers? Almost everybody. And so he's saying, stop doing that, put up your guard, and there are many out there, and you need to test. Emphasis, ask for credentials. Don't, you know, every place, every time you hear a new teacher, suspicion. If you, some of you are new to me, you should treat me with suspicion. Because the statistical probability is that I'm a false teacher. Because that's what the majority is here, so that chance is good. Make a teacher prove himself. Make them have credentials that indicate that they're false. And in this particular scenario, they weren't doing that. So, verse 5 of Jude. Now I desire, present tense means it's a continuing, ongoing thing. It's not a whim. I continually desire to remind you, to remind, aorist tense, I all the time want to give you specific reminders, and I'm paraphrasing. All of the time I want to give you specific reminders, though you all know, you know, perfect tense. Meaning, you have arrived at Christian truth, and you're holding on to it in the present moment. You know all things for all. I desire to remind that you know all things once for all, that the Lord, after saying, present, a saving process, saving a people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed, aorist tense, specific event. So if it's destroyed, it was not a process. We ought to go back and look for an event when God did it. Those destroyed those who did not believe, who did not specifically come to believe. Those who were destroyed and they did not come to believe. Verse 6. And the angels who did not keep, aorist, referring to an event, they did not keep their own domain, but abandoned definite action. Meaning, it was an event in which they decided we abandoned our proper abode. He has kept, perfect tense. Means they're incarcerated and kept there to the present moment. He has kept in eternal bonds under judgment of the great day. Verse 7. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since in the same way as these, indulged, aorist tense, specific event, indulged in gross immorality and went, aorist tense, specific event, after strange flesh, are exhibited, present tense. They did two specific things. They indulged and they went after strange flesh, historic event in time, and they are now being exhibited all of the time as an example in undergoing forever, over and over and over, the punishment of eternal fire. Verse 8. Yet in the same manner these men also by dreaming, present tense, they dream all the time, defile, present tense, they're defiling all of the time, and reject, present tense, they do it all of the time, and revile angelic magic. Look at all the ongoing activity. He's not talking about what they did now, what they're going to do, but look at what is going on right now. The same manner, these men, the apostates, they're dreaming every day. They're defiling every day. They're rejecting authority every day. They're reviling angelic majesties every day, over and over. But, verse 9, Michael the archangel, when he disputed, present tense, must have been a protracted thing. It was not a dispute, but he was continually disputing, and he was arguing, imperfect tense, he was arguing about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce specifically against him a railing judgment, but said on an occasion, specific event, aorist tense, the Lord rebuke, aorist tense, you specifically. And we'll stop there and we'll finish that out tomorrow night. But now, once you get this, you should never again, as long as you live, have to go to an analytical or a parsing guide to know what the tense of those words are. It's marked, it's permanent. John.
Verse 6, he said, he is kept, he marked it perfect because he's in presence.
It is perfect. Has kept is perfect. Yeah. How did you guys get along downstairs with Hans' parsing guide? Let's see, you three went. Do you think you could use it now? Think you could get there?
Yeah, we were here.
Oh, you were here. Okay, Mike, can you handle it now? Who else was down there? You feel comfortable with it? At least can do it? Who else was down there? Pam? Okay. Now it's a matter of just simply sitting by the fireside with Hans' parsing guide with your feet up and just go through and mark those babies all the way through because they're there. Now, let me give you a method for doing the same thing in the Old Testament. And go to the book of Genesis. I realize a lot of this marking is hard to get into your English Bible. You might want to do what we did here. We just put these on the copier and enlarged them, I don't know, 200% or whatever. And you might want to just take something like that in Jude, put it, that's your Jude notebook, and put all your grammatical information in there, and that would be your text. All right. Remember, in Hebrew, we have three different things that are present on every verb. They have a cal verb and a pael verb and a hifil verb. And just like Greek, you'd want to mark those. Cal is just pure statement. I ate. Pure statement. And it would be I ate. For example, PAL takes pure statement and intensifies. It's intensified statement, intensifies. Sometimes to intensify in English, we got to find a different word, and I know someone can someone intensify I ate? Ought to have a whole bunch of suggestions. I gorged, I devoured, someone want to get real idiomatic. I pigged out, it'd be a good ocal, I ate, ikale, I pigged out, or I gorged, or I devoured. Most of the time, in translation, you've got to find a different word for it. They have a way of just taking the word for eat and marking it a certain way so you know it's intensified. And they don't have to change vocabulary. We do. Hifil is causative. And it would mean, I caused to eat. I caused to eat. Genesis 1. Now, here's the way I would mark them, and I think it's very simple. Mark a cal dot. Mark a PAL, 2 dots. Mark a HIFIL, 3 dots. Dot, double dot, triple dot. Okay, reading Genesis. And in the first 4 verses, we will have all 3 of them. In the first 3 verses, first 4 verses, we'll have all 3 of them. In the beginning, God created cal. Give it a dot. The heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving, PAL, 2 dots, was moving intensely. This is intense activity that is there. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw that the light was good, and God separated Hifil. 1, 2, 3, cause to separate. That gives a little slightly different touch. The Hifil could allow that God did not directly separate it, but God caused it to happen. And when you cause something to happen, there might be means. I don't know whether there were or not, but it allows for means. So whether God separated directly or whether he caused to separate, perhaps using means, but it is causative, and the thrust is God is clearly the cause of the firmament. Always remember, and that basically is the way you can mark Hebrew. Now, tomorrow I'll give you a little bit more, and we'll do something with emphasis. And for Old Testament, the emphatic word, remember it's VSO, is always the order, verb, subject, object. Whenever it's changed, then the order is changed. And therefore, going back to 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The order of the Hebrew is verb, created, followed by subject, God, then the object, heavens and the earth. But when you begin verse 2, the word earth is the subject, and he moves it up first. So the order becomes subject first and then verb, and that means underline. So when you come down to verse 2, the emphasis is on the word earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void. Now let me read to you from a book. That is out of print, but it's called Rotherham's emphasized, critically emphasized. This is the New Testament. I loaned my Old Testament to somebody, and I haven't seen it for a long time. But let me read to you how strongly some of these men honored and felt about the little details in God's Word. This man, Rotherham, is writing in the late 1800s. And he says the importance of noticing emphatic words, and he almost gets evangelistic, is if you don't get the right word, don't read it, because all you do is obscure the meaning, and that's essentially what he's going to say. He says, miss the emphatic word, and you miss its meaning. Thus, in reading Hebrews 10:26, to lay the chief stress on the word sin is to misrepresent the passage. It should read, if we sin willfully, or if, double underline, by choice we be sinning. And his emphasis is, don't emphasize sinning because it isn't emphasized. Don't say, if by choice we be sinning. He said that misses the whole meaning. He says the emphasis, and he's correct, is on the words by choice. If by choice we are sinning. And so it's not just a matter of sinning, it's sinning by choice. How do you see that? By seeing the emphatic word. If the question of our Lord in John 6:61 be read, does this offend you? It might almost as well not be read at all. The point is missed and the meaning is lost. It should be read as the Greek shows, does this offend you? And so forth. So I read that just to give you the flavor of a precise man who says if that's emphatic, you need to know it. And if you miss it, you miss the meaning of the passage. And that is important. Remember, emphasis in language says a lot. You can come up to someone and say, I, emphatic, as you look at them, am dressed appropriately. What does that say? Or if a man would say, are you going to wear that dress? It must be okay. But what if he emphasizes, are you going to wear that dress? Does that give a message? Emphasis is very important. In the Greek New Testament, you can take a verse and take the scissors and cut out each individual word, like in John 3:16, put it in a hat, shake it up, and put the sentence back together again. Because every word tells you. If I say I hit him, him is a pronoun, but if you take him out of the hat, is him a direct object? Well, you don't know. In Greek you would. There'll be a little marker. So you can cut up words out of the hat, put the sentence back together, and therefore it allows you to make emphasis on the position of words. And the Greek puts the most emphatic word first, second emphatic last. So that if you come to a verse and you see the first word and the last word, you learn to look at it. Because those are the words that are underscored. And literally, in your text, you would underscore first and last word. And again, the Hebrew does it a little bit differently. But the emphasis, emphatic words are extremely important. Okay, question on what we've been talking about.
Is the emphatic always in a translation first?
Oh, no, never. You can't tell anything from a translation. Translation is a translation. Well, use Hebrew word order translate it in English. Created, followed by God. What's that in English word order? It makes God the object of the verb, doesn't it? Created God. So you can't do that. And I'm not translating it. I'm not criticizing a translation for not doing it. They shouldn't. Because to follow a verb with that is to make it the object. So you definitely ought to reverse it. You just can't tell anything in English. I'm sorry. I've had the same thought. God was not a very good American. He wasn't impressed with English. And we know we're the most important people on earth, but apparently he didn't think so. Okay, any question on that before we go back to Jude? Question about these positions. Is this objective or subjective? The position of the verb and object. It's objective, isn't it? It's just there. And therefore, if it's just there, what do you need to learn to do? Observe. And see it there. Okay, just a little. Let's take a few minutes and do this. On our last session this afternoon, we asked the group up here to make observations on Acts 1:8. And so let's go to that. But in going to it, let me say some things about observations. And I don't think we've done observations, but I don't think we've ever organized it. And let's organize it into two parts. When we read the Bible, and keep in mind our emphasis this week is not just on teaching it, but learning tools whereby we can really read it for ourselves and verify and check those who teach us. The nature of an observation. What is an observation? An observation is the power of noticing. An observation refers to the power of noticing. Underscore that definition. It is the power of noticing. And may we say on that, it can be increased if you get pushed. You can notice better than you used to if you want to. And if you put the effort to it. I appreciated, Don, your comment. You want to make it? You've observed before, but you said something about this afternoon that you went a little farther than you normally would. And again, it's because we said that we want 20 observations out of Acts 1:8, and if you can't produce them, for each one you fall short, you make a $10 contribution to Word of Truth. So this motivated him a little bit. And as you can see, you can stretch. You can work on your power to notice and increase it a great deal. And that's important. Remember, your mind is like anything else. Don't use it and it will atrophy. Don't use it and it won't work anymore. And that's very important to learn to do. Is Mom here? Did she walk out on me? Oh, you're back there. Do you still do the crossword puzzle morning and evening routine? I'm talking to you. Yeah. Is your name Betty? Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. You see how the mind atrophies? With non-use. You heard her. She said, Betty, Betty who? That's what happens. And you know, that seriously is a good practice. Something like a crossword puzzle in the morning, one in the evening. It makes you think. And it keeps you active. And that really needs to be done. Especially for those of you guys who are getting older. You tend, don't you, to say, well, I don't need to push anymore. And I work on it. Put forth effort on the power of noticing. Now, let's say a couple of things about that. That the power of noticing is innate to a degree in all men. All do not have the same ability, and we recognize that. If a person is noticeably deficient in ability to notice, we say he is kind of dull. On the other hand, some have a greater ability to, and by the way, people who don't have much power to notice, or at least don't put forth an effort to notice, are people that ignore a lot of things. And that's why we call them ignorant people. Or ignorant, as we would pronounce it. Ignorant simply means you don't notice anything. It all goes past you, and you never seem to see it. If we see somebody who is really alert, we have even developed idioms, have we not? We may say he is, if he is dull, the person that notices a lot, we say he is really sharp. Or have you ever used the expression, boy, he doesn't miss a trick. What does that mean? It means it's all out there, but with this person it just went on by, and with someone else they just seem to pick up on everything. Now some of that is innate ability, but a lot of it is effort. And I want to encourage you in the area of observations, especially with regard to the Bible, there. Now, while it's innate in all, and it can be developed, we ought to note this. There is a special dimension that noticing has when you study the Bible. And that is this. Your spiritual condition can dull your observing power. Carnality can dull you. Let's look at two passages. First, Hebrews 5:11. There's a natural dimension where we observe, but there's also a spiritual dimension to it that if we're in a certain condition, we won't be able to observe like we could otherwise. Of course, it's correctable, but we ought to know that we can be dulled. And Hebrews 5:11 notes it. He's speaking about Christ as the high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And if you can picture the man trying to teach, and he sees that nothing is really happening out there. And so he says, concerning him, we have much to say. Notice, no lack of data. No lack of information. Plenty of it out there. Concerning him, we have much to say. And it's hard to explain. What does he mean by that? That he can't find words for it? No. Does he mean he can't teach it? No. It's hard to explain why. Since you have become dull of hearing. What is the problem? The problem is on the listening end. Plenty of information, plenty of truth, plenty of data, but you're spiritually a dunce. So it's possible to be spiritually dull through carnality, and not be able to perceive. What other passage should we put with that? How about 1 Corinthians 3:1-3, where Paul says, I can't feed your babes, I can only feed you milk. You can't take in anything better than that. Why? Because you're carnal. So keep in mind that to observing and the power of noticing when it comes to spiritual truth has a special dimension, and that is it is affected by carnality. So following definition, let's say something then about the tools. Pen, pad, text, and power to notice. Developing it every day. Pen, pad, text, power to notice. As with many things, people who do something really well inevitably do it different than they're taught in school. You ever notice that? People who do something really well inevitably violate most of the quote-unquote rules. About 3 years ago in Stonington, Connecticut, we were walking one evening out, beautiful place there out near Mystic, and the person I was with, some of you may remember in the distant past, you remember the Christy Minstrels? The lead singer, interesting thing, became a Christian through, she said, you know, we traveled, and she said we couldn't be together because we all hated one another. And I said, well, that's interesting. It didn't look like that way in the street. Well, see, that's the way it is. We all hated one another. And therefore, we had separate rooms and didn't do anything together. And she said, I got in a room and pulled open a drawer, and there was the tape. And it was something we'd done on Romans, and she played it, became interested, became a Christian. And that time when I went out, she wanted to be baptized, and we baptized her in the ocean. And Nanette, we were walking in Mystic. And she said, I know an author that I'd like for you to meet. He said, you're working on a novel right now for Shimon Schmooster. And he said, I'd like for you to meet him. You'll find him really interesting. And, of course, liking to write, I was interested in talking to someone like that. So we went to his home right down on the water and went in to, he had just made his whole home his office. He was a bachelor. And saw the strangest thing. Here was a blue clothesline tied across the room. Here was a green one. Here was a red one. Here was an orange one. And I thought, well, this is bizarre. Because on each one of them were hanging 3x5 cards. Just like on a clip, like you hang clothes. And at certain points, they were crossed like this. Like a blue one would cross a red one. And there'd be a little wad of cards right there at the point where they crossed over. And I thought, well, this is... You know, something's odd enough, you feel like you can really... I said, can I ask you, sir, what this is? And he says, do you write? And I said, yes. He said, do you ever get vapor lock on the first sentence? Have you ever got vapor lock on the first sentence? You sit down to write, and everything shuts down. And you sit there for 3 hours, and you haven't written the first sentence yet. And that's very common. And he said, I took a course once in a composition... He said, I stayed for 2 days and it was so bad. So they tried to teach me to outline. And he said, I never outlined in my life. He said, this is the dumbest thing. He says, here's what I do. He said, today I went out with a man up here that has been sailing in this ocean and fishing for almost 30 years. He said, I took along a pencil and a pad and went fishing with him. And everything I saw, I said, I'm going to write a good sentence about that. He said, I watch him bait his hook. Can you write a good sentence about what he's doing? Can you describe it in words? And he said, I'd try to create a good sentence. Came home with 25, 30 cards, good sentences, rubber banded them together, and hung them on the blue line because the blue line was this fisherman. Then he said, I may go out with a guy that's never been off of Manhattan, and he's a businessman, and he's always been on the island, and one that always has to ask for coffee. And so he said, I made him a red line. I went out with him for a day. And all I did was have fun. I just wrote good sentences about what he said. He said, I quoted him. I said, would you say that again so I can write that down? And he said, I do this for several months. Red line is the businessman. The blue line is the fisherman. The yellow line may be who knows who else. And he said, I just move around. And he says, pretty soon I sit down in my study here and I begin to think, what if this blue line meets the, what if this blue line fisherman meets the businessman? And he said, I think I remember something that the fisherman said that would blow the businessman's mind. So I take those cards and I cross the lines over and I pin them right there, because that's where these two characters are going to meet. He says, pretty soon I develop characters, I develop stories, and out of it comes a novel. Now, that's not the way anyone had that done in English comp. And again, it's interesting that very often people who do the best do it the opposite of the way it's often taught to do. Now, that was to illustrate something. Yeah, okay. You, most people think of Bible study, you got to be elaborate, don't they? Pen, pad, Bible text, power to observe. And with that, you can go to work immediately and do it. Now, you learn a few things. For example, we talk something about commentaries and critique some. In my list of priorities, the commentary is the last thing I ever pick up. The very last thing I ever pick up. Because the first thing is to take the text and read it. Oh, I don't know. Depending on its length, get the portion you're going to work with, and time yourself. I can read through this in 7 minutes. Okay, do that three times in the morning. That's 21 minutes. And at lunch, do it three more. In the evening, do it three more. Do that for a week. And if it's a matter of 10 verses, what will you all of a sudden see has happened to you? You know it by heart. I guess we haven't talked about memorizing by the whole method. That's the only way to memorize, by the whole method. Take the portion and read it through and make no attempt to memorize. None. The more you try to memorize, the harder it is to. Don't do it that way. Just read it. And then all of a sudden, one day, you knew it. I remember that happening with 1 John. And I can remember the first time I sat in the library and out in the middle where I could read the Bible and also watch girls come through the door. And I remember successfully reading through 1 John in the Greek New Testament. And so I began reading it and reading it and reading it. And it took about 2 months and I knew 1 John by heart in Greek. And the point I'm making, I was surprised. I wasn't trying to memorize it. I didn't know I was memorizing, but that's what happened. Give it a shot sometime. You take something, a couple of paragraphs, and you read them morning, noon, and night. Do it for a week or so, and one day, all of a sudden, you don't need to read it anymore. You got it memorized. That's called the whole method of reading, of memorizing. Don't do what so many of us have done. For God so loved the world. For God so loved the world. For God so loved the world. Yeah, for God so loved the world. And then the next day, you cut off the next piece of the dog's tail, that he gave his only begotten son, that he gave his only begotten son, that he gave his only begotten or forgotten, begotten son. And you try to memorize that way. And that's the worst in the world, because when you memorize the last segment, completely disassociated from the first, your mind can't handle that. Your mind is not meant, your mind is meant to organize and to put together. And it wants things that make sense. And fragments like that don't make sense to your mind. And by the time you get down to the last one, you can't remember what the first one was. And if you have to do it in public, that's the quickest way to forget the whole stupid thing, is to have memorized it by fragments, because public or stage fright fragmentizes all of the segments that you glued together. And it doesn't take much for them to come all unglued and you're with it. So Very simple. Just try doing the simple thing. And what you will find that by the time you've read it this many times, you can read the commentary real fast because you've seen stuff that he didn't even look at. And you wonder, does this commentator ever read the text? Really? And you'll find out that that is not the case. We're not going to get to do it, but I wanted to take a couple more sessions with Jude and then at the end of it tell you, have you learned anything about Jude? And then tell you, to this point, not one single commentary has been consulted. And you find how much you can discover without a commentary. The markings you put in your Bible, I don't know of a commentary in the world that will give you that. It's there, but they just don't give it to you. Commentators do funny things. They all assume that you've read every piece of literature ever written in history about this thing. And they say, as we all recall from Horace, and then to show that they are scholars, they put it in German. And we all understand the Schlegelmeistermaus, you know, or Latin, and as though it would not be scholarly to say it in decent English. And I'm not exaggerating. If you look through some of the comments, you guys that had the critical commentary, did you see that yesterday in a whole bunch of stuff that meant nothing to you?
The one that pops in my mind is the Expositor's Greek New Testament. Mm-hmm. Always quote in Latin. Mm-hmm. Forever quote. Can't make head or tail of that.
In most PhD programs in the area of Bible interpretation, German is a requirement for that reason. You know, not that it's a special language, but if you're going to read the literature, the literature assumes that anybody that reads this knows at least six languages. And that's often the assumption of scholarly literature. But what we've done here did not come out of a commentary. It came out of the text. Okay. Observations is... Oh, we're not going to get anywhere we got to get this week. Can you guys stay Friday? Okay. Okay, we made some observations on Acts 1:8, and we made 20 of them. Some of you guys contribute something else that you saw. Let me give you a couple of things that they saw. Acts 1:8. Forget Jude again. Okay, we said make the observation on 1:8. Almost across the board, everybody observed something that I didn't think you would catch. You observe that Acts 1:8 is the response to a question in 1:6. And the principle of interpretation they applied is you're not going to get me to comment on Acts 1:8 without looking at the context. Because Acts 1:8 is, if you got a red letter edition, it's the middle of a sentence. And the sentence that begins in verse 7 is a response to the question in verse 6. So the first observation was verse 8 is a fragment. And it is a fragment of a response to a question. And that is good thinking. Because you weren't drawn out, and I was disappointed. I thought everybody would jump into verse 8 and try to make observations without the context, but you didn't do it. So that's good. You observe context. Now, someone give me an observation that we have not made. What, and something did you see? Remember, an observation meets scientific standards. It's provable. It's empirical. It's there. Okay? Someone want to wax, as we said, wax allegorical. Or wax eloquent.
You say the power is not something that they would have to work for.
Okay, observation. The power that they are going to receive would not be due to effort. Is that there? Would you tell me if I say, I don't see that there. Will you want to try and show it to me?
You shall receive.
Shall receive. Not shall obtain or shall work for or shall earn, but shall receive. You're arguing on the basis of passive voice. Passive voice is subject being acted upon. Active voice is the subject producing the action. So they're going to be acted upon. So this then apparently is going to be a gracious fulfillment of a promise. Question for all you, that is that fair? Is that in the text? Or did he read that in? Is that lifted out or read into? It's lifted out, isn't it? It's a good observation. Okay? Come on, guys. You did well this afternoon. Now you're chance to perform. Children always clam up when you want them to perform. Do something for... You have a gallery listening. Okay, Don?
Well, the timing of this is it's going to be a point of time. But this isn't going to happen before that. So it's according to God's timing.
Okay, you're emphasizing that the there is a time element in it. Is that fixed by chronology, or is it fixed by an event? It's going to be fixed by an event. There's going to be an event. And when that event happens, this is going to occur. Okay? Oh, we also observed something else. We talked about you've got to cross to understand the geography thing. Is there any geography in Acts 1:8? And there is Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, utmost parts of the earth. And therefore, there is geography that's going to say, how is their witness going to go forth? It's going to go out in concentric circles. Also learn, if you're going to be teaching, also try to learn to illustrate. How would you illustrate give me a good illustration or illustration of it's going to start at Jerusalem and move outward. Give me something visual that people could really see. Okay, drop a rock in the water and you have a splash and then you have circles going out. That gives a visual. Any other? Okay, nuclear explosion. Can you illustrate this with a game? When we say something has a blank effect. Domino effect. That can illustrate it. How do you come up with those how do we come up with those? We all went, and they're published, illustration books. And I wonder, why in the world would you ever want to go to an illustration book? Why don't you just think? And interact with it yourself. So learn to develop illustrations from everything you do. Have I grossed everyone with my latest illustration out? Have I told all of you about the lab?
Oh, yeah.
I guess I haven't told all of you. Last week, Don and Patty Gaddis, who've been gone from here, I think, 12 years or something like that, came through while they were in Dallas, and they flew up for dinner and then flew back the next day. And he's an engineer, and he was telling me about visiting, because of his job, visiting a lab where they were doing experimentation with chemical warfare. And he said he went in, and here were these six men with all kinds of protective garb and rubber gloves on. And he said down at the end was what looked like a kitchen chopping block. And on it was a large machete-like knife. He said, it was razor sharp. And he said, would you mind to tell me what that is down there? And they said, well, if in working with these chemicals, we should puncture a rubber glove and prick our finger with it, we know that we've got about 10 seconds to do one of two things. A, die. B, go down there and chop your finger off. That's a beautiful illustration of insanity. It's a beautiful illustration of in the Old Testament. You look and God says, I want you to go in. I don't want you to kill the men in Canaan, the women and the children and the cattle. Wipe out everything that lives. And you say, that's extreme. Well, when you study the religion of Canaan, it was cutting out a horrible segment of, and if you read about Canaanite practice, you suddenly realize this has got to be cut out. Or it will literally pervert and would have perverted Israel so they could have literally been wiped out by the judgment of God. And therefore, God said the surgery has to be radical. We've got to take it all out. So kill the men, women, and children, which was an act of wonderful grace. Grace toward the children, because they probably went to heaven. And grace toward the rest of Palestine, because the paganism of the land was literally removed. Just like the choice is very critical. Do you want to live, or will you surrender a finger? And cutting off a finger, it's just not something, I don't know if I could do it or not. But perhaps if you really knew, you got 10 seconds, you want to live? Maybe you could cut it off. Ordinarily you couldn't. But when you get in a dramatic situation like that, then it probably would become much more much easier. We got time for, you got one more observation you guys saw? Jerry.
Gentiles.
Say that again.
It appears that they're going to go out and evangelize the Gentiles.
Why does it appear that they're going to go out and evangelize the Gentiles?
Because it says go to the remotest parts of the earth.
Okay. And it's going to Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, which would involve Jews, and then it leapfrogs, doesn't it? So there's the first hint in Jesus' word that the gospel is going to go to the world. The first hint of world evangelism, the first hint, really, of what is about to dramatically happen. We're going to leave the borders of Palestine, and that would be striking. How many times did Jesus leave Palestine? Never did. Confined to that little tiny nation, and now it's going to go to the whole world. So you got the seedbed, do you not? And you say, well, that's not much of an observation. Well, remember when Peter, later on, was told to go to Cornelius? He says, no way. Well, Jesus had already given a hint. Clear back here in Acts 1:8. Good observation, yeah.
This further substantiates, in my mind, the question that comes toward when they were in the upper room. It says they were of one accord. I have a hard time thinking that means that there was peace and quiet up there, because that's the last thing he said to them. And knowing the Jewish mentality, I can't imagine them being a happy.
You can hear him up there saying, no way.
Yeah.
No way. I never had anything that wasn't kosher my whole life. No way.
I just can't see that one accord means peace and tranquility.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Okay. All right. We'll pick up with it again in the morning. We need to do connectives. We need to do interpreting symbols, interpreting parables. We'll get it in. Maybe.
Can you get these ladies to keep these meals covered for another week?
What?
Can you get these ladies to keep these meals covered for another week?
I think we have enough food left over for another week. For you ladies that have done work and might not be here tomorrow, we really want to thank you. You've done a great job. The meals were super. If you haven't gotten acquainted with some of these people, take a minute to mix in. Father, we're